RNN.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means.
Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel.
Tonight's featured show is Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. Welcome to the Republic News Network for our live national broadcast. You may call me Kelby, and tonight I'm going to be acting as your moderator. The RNN, which stands for the Republic News Network, has been doing this radio show since 2010, and it's always been a friendly introduction for the people of the United States Corporation. Here we go. It's true. The United States is a federal corporation, and their exclusive jurisdiction is in the District of Columbia. The Republic government was simply a bunch of U.S. citizens that, in law, don't have access to the Bill of Rights, and they realized they wanted to be Americans, as our founders and our law provided each and every one of us. See, we've been hard at work since 2008, and since 2010, we have successfully re-inhabited the original government vacated under Lincoln in 1861. I know, it's hard to understand. Don't worry. We are law-abiding, peaceful Americans and very pro-government, and we love our country. You can consider the Republic members are tired of the corruption that we see every day. See, we found in the law that there is two forms of government here on the land, and we did something about it. We are people. Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, we have families just like you. We simply found some truths, and now we're sharing these important truths with the rest of the world. So get ready to hear things that sound amazing, and get ready to understand that you, too, are about to be a part of history. We welcome each one of you to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel and your Republic, if you so choose. But before we go into our broadcast tonight, please bow your head in prayer.
Thank you for this opportunity to just have another show where we can express our freedom and express our rights. Lord, just be blessed by us and protect these people as they go forward in their day-to-day lives. And we ask this in your son's name. Amen. Mr. Happel, I yield the floor to you.
Well, thank you, Kelby. Tonight we have two young men on our program that I really think will make our listeners very proud of the fact that our young people, not all of them are completely immersed in computers and all the negative things that are, let's say, grabbing their minds. These young men are both very intelligent, very involved, and they will tell our listeners exactly how America can be saved and how Americans can be tuned back into their own country. These young men are really activists in making America aware, and then ways that we can bring our country back. So with that, I would like to introduce first Dan Johnson. And Dan, I would like to give you a little bit of an opportunity to describe some of the programs, a little about yourself and some of the programs that you've worked on, and what you are doing now, and how it's impacting the direction of our country.
All right. Well, there's a high bar to meet, but good to be on the show, Dan. I got into activism back in 2012, and in 2012, I saw a video on the National Defense Authorization Act. Basically, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, the Japanese-American detention of 1942 authorized basically the detention of 120,000 Japanese-Americans under Executive Order 9066. And the exact same authority was passed under the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, where the president could detain without a charge or trial indefinitely any person who he merely suspected of being a terrorist. And I simply couldn't abide by that. I couldn't see that America should abide by that and start an organization, which we eventually grew to one of the largest civil liberties organizations in the country, fighting that legislation state to state and city to city. Eventually, we had 7 jurisdictions go against and protect their citizens from the 2012 NDAA. We actually have a bill active in the Idaho legislature on that that's going to be voted on tomorrow morning. So we're pretty happy about that. I also went from there to start an activist training center. We helped about 75 different organizations advance various causes. And now I'm the executive director of We Do Better. And the general concept is there are many ways of providing public services. The government, nonprofits, business, informal groups of people, et cetera. The vast majority of our public services are actually provided by informal groups, businesses, nonprofits, i.e. we the people, but the vast majority of our resources are going to the government. I'm pretty sure just about anyone from any walk of life can agree that that is probably a problem, and We Do Better is setting out to fix it. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, and I have to say I'm so incredibly impressed. I met you through Debbie Boskalupi, and I was so incredibly impressed with someone as young as you are being so not only articulate but being so aware of all the different things that you're aware of that are changing this country and turning us from a great constitutional republic into basically a slave state. And not only that, but a socialist or slash socialist communist country that depends heavily on government control of everything. And that was never what was intended by our founders. And it's so unusual to find a young person, certainly someone your age, that really fully understands that. And I have to say, you absolutely amaze and impress me every time I hear you speak. So that's why I thought it was very important that our listeners get a chance to meet you over the air and understand some of the things you're working on. Jeff, I would like to, Jeff Lewis is a young man who has been working with Dan Johnson, and Jeff has got quite an impressive background of his own, and I would like to give you this opportunity, Jeff, to talk a little bit about your experiences and some of your background and how that fits into We Do Better.
Good evening, Dan. Well, I'm a Gulf War veteran. My families are direct descendants of both Lightbearer's pirates and American revolutionaries. And I was brought up to believe in a set of principles and values that mirrored what the founding fathers expressed in the Declaration of Independence and Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which was written for the average voter. But I could say I got two phone calls. Two contacts. One was a letter and one was a phone call from future generations of America concerned about what was going on. One was my niece and the other was Mr. Johnson. And as a trailing age baby boomer, I realized that my debt to God and country was not paid by my service in the military, that it didn't expire at the duty. And the duty isn't to the piece of paper, it's to the people, we the people. So after being in the military, being a general contractor, I worked in a variety of different different businesses. Worked at NASA. I got into activism, and in 2012, Mr. Johnson called me out of the blue. And you keep calling him a young man. I knew him 6 years ago when he was a teenager, and I've worked with some of the best lawyers minds in the country, fighting for the rights of the people, little guy. And I had a lot of intel coming into my inbox and all the different ways you get information. And this kid calls me from Ohio to alert me about a bill in Congress that was walking all over the Bill of Rights. And I looked at it. It was the Federal Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act. Sounds rather harmless. But when I got looking at it, it sounded like what he was saying about it was right. I reached out to my attorney, our general counsel, the nonprofit I was running, and he agreed. And so I got this teenage kid calling me, alerting me about something that the people, and you can keep calling me young, I'm 55, that the people my age and older hadn't even noticed. The more I spoke with Mr. Johnson, the more I saw how brilliant he was. I heard what you were saying about him before we came on the air. You said 40-year-old. I'd say he's wiser than most 50 or 60-year-olds I know. Because he seeks the truth, and he, when he called me up about working with advising We Do Better, it was to address a problem or a series of problems. I said, if you're just looking at managing the problem, I'm not interested. If you're looking at solving it, count me in. Mm-hmm. And. We spent a couple of years developing and researching the concept that became We Do Better, and it is the best thing since sliced bread, because it recognizes that we is not the company or the organization. The we and We Do Better is we the people, and we always do better looking out for ourselves than the government could if it tried.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't try.
It is about control.
Well, Jeff, I guess I apologize for calling you a young man, but you're a young man compared to me. But trust me, that wasn't intended as a slur at all. But about Dan.
I didn't take it that way. I like being called young because I'm starting to feel old.
Yeah. Well, the opposite is definitely nothing we aspire to do. Although I have to say, when people say, "Well, you're getting older," I say, "Well, thank God," you know.
Really.
Because the other alternative isn't that red hot. So I know that you went through some life-changing experiences in your life because of, your military career, but also because of 4 bouts with cancer. And tell us a little bit about your experience and how that kind of brought a new meaning to your life.
Well, you know, when you're young, you feel like you're Superman and you're going to live forever anyway. That's why you aspire to jump off tall buildings, over tall buildings with a single bound, you know. But at some point, you realize you do have a mortality that, you know, everybody's time is numbered. And you should make the best of it. And about the time I was recovering from stage 4 aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I got that letter from my niece, who was married to an Army officer stationed in Japan. I got two great nephews, so she had two boys and another one on the way, and was concerned about what kind of country she was going to be bringing her kids into. So she writes her favorite uncle, it's like what I was saying earlier about the God and country bit. I looked around, and it was like everything I was brought up to believe was important, was worth fighting and dying for, was on fire. And yet people were just sitting on their butts, like in that flood insurance commercial where the house fills up with water and the dad still keeps sitting there reading the paper and the dog floats away on the coffee table. It was time to get involved. I couldn't let that letter from Japan be a scarlet letter, because that would have been saying, sorry, kiddo, that's life. It would be denied everything that I, like I said, was brought up to believe was right. It ain't about left and right, it's about right and wrong. And every generation of Americans, since its founding, aspired for their kids to have a better life than they did, to not have it as tough as they did. And up till the baby boomers, arguably, that was pretty much true. My generation dropped the ball. But it's not too late to pick it back up.
Mm-hmm.
And remember who we are as a people, and how we the people working together, doing what the framers said, to put our differences aside and work together for the common good. That if we would just do that, we'd do better.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
so kids and grandkids. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's probably a really good segue into what We Do Better is all about. And Dan, I know from talking to you that your work with the NDAA, I know you've done work trying to expose UN Agenda 21. You've been involved with legislatures on a number of ticklish issues. And what I can say from you, or for you, I guess, is that you are all about solutions and you are all about getting things done. And boy, what a breath of fresh air, because we can talk about all the problems, but very few people offer a lot of different good solutions. And that's what you and your organization is all about. So I would love to have you tell our listeners some of the things that you've been working on, and then how your organization works and how it is really a fundamentally necessary concept if we're going to pull this mess out of the hopper.
Well, that's quite the broad set of topics, and it's dangerous to give a public speaker that much time to speak. But the first thing I have to say is I think people forget that liberty and tyranny have real consequences. I think that, I've been to many meetings of various groups that were wonderful, that you sat down, you discussed maybe the Constitution, you discussed a lot of different threats to freedom and liberty, and then everyone packs up and goes home. And then they do the same thing the next month. And while there is a need, there's absolutely a need for education, everything starts at education. We have to remember that every hour, every day, every week, every year that we simply discuss issues and how bad it is, there are real people being harmed all over this country. There are real people who can't afford to pay for their kids' breakfast. There are real people who are living on the street. There are real people and real consequences to our actions as activists, and we have to shoulder a bit of responsibility that we can't decide to back away from solutions and just talk about the problems, even though that might be easier, because at the end of the day, if we don't provide solutions, then those people will be stuck in their cycles. And so I have always been someone about solutions. I've joked to many people that one of the reasons that I've started three national organizations is I don't like losing. And I don't like seeing the people lose. And my focus on We Do Better actually came out of a whiteboard that myself and my marketing director sat down and put together, which was, what is it? What is it that defines and separates government from anything else? And what is it that government does that no one else does? And what we found with the answer to the second question is very little. Right now, today, there are organizations all across America and across the world that provide very similar public services to the government, or rather the government, being the smaller entity, provides very similar resources and services to them. And these organizations outperform government agencies in outcomes for people 5, 10, 15 to 1. Looking at a broad scale, just as an example, are you guys familiar with the Cajun Navy at all?
No, that's not something I'm familiar with.
So the Cajun Navy is a loose affiliation of Louisiana boat owners. They've got walkie-talkies, they've got boats, and what they do is when the disaster hits, they go out and rescue people. And of course, the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Coast Guard, their missions are somewhat similar. And when Hurricane Harvey hit Texas and destroyed a good amount of the Texas coast, the Cajun Navy sprang into action. The Cajun Navy, at the end of the day, rescued over 6,000 people from the floodwaters of Hurricane Harvey, and the Coast Guard only rescued 4,500. Now, the Cajun Navy did this with probably 1/100th, if not 1/1,000th, of the resources of the Coast Guard. And while it's not to say the Coast Guard didn't do a good job, I'm sure everyone who was saved by them would love them to do it again, but it is to say that there are so many organizations out there right now today that provide a better resource, better public services than the government. And the problem is that A, people don't know about them, and B, people really can't support them with their public service resources, i.e. their tax dollars. And what We Do Better is advancing is, number one, we're creating a website, socialsafety.net. That website will be a search engine where anyone can type in what they need and their zip code and find a list of organizations in their area that provide that or address that need. And number two is, once people find the organizations that that provide better public services than the government, number two is to be able to fund those. And we work off of the Arizona Charitable Credit, which has been in Arizona for the past 20 years, and allows taxpayers to direct now up to 400 of their state tax dollars to any organization in Arizona that serves the poor. We've modified that legislation all around the country, and we would like to see the taxpayers, the people in their communities, be able to send their resources to those who do better. In many cases, that's we the people.
That's amazing. That's what a wonderful concept. The fact that, you know, private industry has always done a much better job in national emergencies and in things like that than the government. I mean, they're just so much more efficient. And the bottom line is that they care a lot more. And that's at the heart of what you're trying to do with this. That's absolutely amazing, Dan.
Tell us a little bit about how those tax credits work. And I know you've got legislation going on pretty much nationwide, if I'm not mistaken.
So the way the tax credit works is actually really simple. Unlike a tax deduction, which you probably are going to get about 25 cents on the dollar if you donate to charity, so you're still losing about 25 cents, what we're looking at is the tax system, and by virtue of it, the government, was designed to be a place where people put their money collectively to solve social problems. And if there's a way to solve social problems or to address public needs outside of the government that doesn't have many of the flaws that you've mentioned and the flaws we talk about on our website, WeDoBetter.org, if those organizations are simply providing a better public service, then those dollars, which would otherwise be used and maybe wasted by government agencies, should go to those organizations that provide those services. So the way the credit works in Arizona is throughout the year, any taxpayer can donate about $400, or if they're married filing jointly, it's $800. But they can donate about $400 to any organization in the state. And then at the end of the year, when they file their taxes, they simply tell the government, by the way, these are the charities I've donated to. I gave them this amount of money. And they're able to reduce their tax bill by exactly that amount. So it's a dollar-for-dollar reduction, or what we call the redirecting of tax dollars. The money never enters the government's hands. There's no refund involved. It's simply the taxpayer sending their money to those that they believe provide the best services for their community, and then taking that directly off of their tax bill. And over the past 20 years, Arizonan taxpayers have directed over $209 million to these organizations that provide better public services. And you can see the impact in just, I just want to, if I can, I know I'm talking for a little bit, but if I can tell one quick story of the impact.
No, sure, sure, go ahead.
I sat down with a nonprofit leader who runs a domestic violence shelter in Phoenix, in the Phoenix area. And he had been around, the shelter had been around for 28 years. And he was one of our last nonprofits we were interviewing. He was taking notes the entire time, so I knew this guy was going to be well prepared for our interview. And he sits in front of the camera, and the first thing out of his mouth is, our organization is 80% funded by state and federal grants. To which I kind of, okay, all right, well, we're going to get an opposite opinion here. And what he actually said was, it is time for nonprofits to stop relying on federal and state grants. And so I asked him, well, why? What is the reason? And he wanted to give me just a quick example. And he said, the Department of Justice gives us grants for our domestic violence shelter. And those grants include a restriction on spending any of that money on anything having to do with pets, dogs, cats, et cetera. We can only spend the money on, excuse me, on the women that are actually at the shelter. He said, and that sounds pretty innocent, but one third of women will not leave their abusive partner unless they can bring their pet with them. They don't want to leave that pet, that animal, with that person. And he said, now that people have been able to donate to his shelter through the tax credit and been able to direct their dollars toward him, they've been able to actually build a room for pets and invite that many, much more women into their shelter. That's just one example of the power of when you give the taxpayers the ability to choose who does a better job in their community, the impact it can make.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense. I mean, I've seen it myself. When I was a county commissioner, we had a community where hurricane force winds came through the community and pretty much tore out buildings at the airport. A lot of the buildings on Main Street were damaged, and we just had a community effort. People from all over the county came into the community, and within 3 days they had everything buttoned up. And about 2 weeks later, the state came in, and about a month later, the feds came in and offered a bunch of money to do repairs or do whatever in the community, and 90% of it had already been done by private enterprise and been done effectively and had literally thwarted a very serious situation. And it was easy, and the people enjoyed it, and they worked together, and it worked well. Dan, would you tell me how you are working with We Do Better on legislation that's being pushed around the country to help promote these kind of programs?
Absolutely. So I am proud to announce on this show, being that it's the first radio show we've done since we heard the news, that even though We Do Better is only 4 months old, started in October, that our very first piece of legislation has been introduced and was introduced in the state of California on Friday. Senate Bill 1485 is the universal charitable credit for the state of California, and we could not be more excited about that getting introduced in that state, especially in a state that, as goes California, so goes the nation. What we are actively doing at We Do Better is we have, and Jeff actually can talk a little bit about it, as he's the man behind the curtain who writes most of the legislation. But we've written legislation for many states, cities, and counties around the country and write legislation on request as people want to see it in their neighborhood. And that legislation authorizes taxpayers to direct up to 500 of their tax dollars at the state level, or about a quarter of their tax dollars at the local level, to organizations run by We the People and who provide public services in their community. And it works exactly like the Arizona Charitable Credit, except it has slightly less restrictions on it. They have a restriction that requires the charity to spend 50% of its revenue on people who are 150% or less above the poverty line. And not only is that arbitrary, but it gets the State Department of Revenue involved, which we don't want to do. There's no reason to include any extra regulation here. But our goal is to see at least one universal charitable credit pass through a county, a city, or a state by the end of 2018. And if you're listening and you're saying, you know what, the taxpayers in my community, the people in my community should be able to choose for the betterment of the people that need our help the most, you can go to wedobetter.org. You can scroll down to Universal Charitable Credit. You can find one for your state or request one if you haven't seen one for your state on the website.
Okay, great. Now, I would like to get Jeff back into the conversation. I know, as you say, he's been working on a lot of this legislation. He's crafted a number of these bills. Jeff, would you kind of explain how you started with this process working with Dan and how you became involved in the legislative effort that he's doing right now?
Well, I didn't get into the weeds a while ago when you were asking me about how I got where I am. I've been a full-time citizen activist for, I'm in my 13th year.
Okay.
I've had active legislation that I wrote in Congress the past six Congresses. Legislation, I'll say when I got good at it is because I worked with one of the best attorneys in the country that money can't buy. that taught me the law of the Constitution, not constitutional law. And there's a difference. Because the Constitution is supposed to be the supreme law of the land, and we are supposed to be writing laws in pursuance of it, you know, in words that the average voter, the average citizen can understand. Because if you can't understand the laws that you're supposed to be governing you, and you're supposed to be self-governing, but I was taught early on by my dad that words matter. Words mean something. You say what you mean what you say. I had to learn how to read the legislation to start with, and then when the 2012 NDAA came up, it was so complicated because the way it was written was very convoluted and confusing. You actually had to spend some time to fully wrap your mind around the issue. And so it's kind of like writing a term paper in school on an issue. If you're writing it for Joe and Jane Citizen to be able to understand, and you can form complete sentences and complete thoughts, that it's really not that difficult to write legislation if you learned how to write theses and term papers in high school or college. But I don't think they teach people how to read and write anymore, or how to think, just what to think. trial and error, and we put together a 15-page resolution that was educational, because it was a lot you needed to know to wrap your mind around it, and most people couldn't tell you how many articles are in the Constitution, let alone what's in them. We just jumped in feet first and started writing legislation, writing amendments and resolutions, and now when we say we will roll into Montana to do a Montana Universal Charitable Credit, our legal team would look at your existing statutes, look at how your bills are currently written, because your current legislature and your bill drafters and your lawyers there are accustomed to writing the law a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it's different in every state. So we have to tailor it at some level so that we're not conflicting with something that your state prohibits or requires, either one, and in a format that makes it easy for the legislators and for the bill drafting and for the legal beagles to understand. Because we want to get it right. And mm-hmm. we want the people that have to live under it to understand the rules of the game. And this is something that's designed to empower the average taxpayer and to restore the gift of giving and to get people reengaged with their local church, their local community, their local businesses. That's what self-governance is all about. Is being responsible,
right?
And treating each other like human beings, and working together. Jefferson said, "Government that governs closest governs best." Well, if we're supposed to be self-governing, then that's who he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Was we the people? and the Universal Charitable Credit Act helps facilitate that, helps remind us who we are as a people and what we can accomplish working together to make living on this ball floating around the sun better.
Well, and do it in a way that private individuals, that it's their conscious decision to support these things rather than having the money coerced out of them to use in ways that they may be diametrically opposed to. I think that's the important part.
Absolutely. It's not special interest groups or bureaucrats picking and choosing winners and losers. Each individual, if they got anybody to blame for how that money is spent, it's them the next time they give them money. It's themselves. And people will vote with their dollar. We didn't put the restriction that the money be spent in that state like the Arizona credit does, because that's a restriction on the person whose money it was in the first place. That's redirecting
right.
it. And if they're supporting a charity in that state that is supporting people in some other part of the country that's going through a famine or a flood or whatever, well, if they know that's what they're doing with the money and that's what they're wanting to do is help those other people, then that's their business.
Okay, good, good. Well, it sounds like such a logical concept, and it doesn't surprise me a bit that this is something that you and Dan would be working on, because I know certainly from Dan's perspective, and I know him much better than you, but I know that Dan has always been very active in a return to constitutional government, and in that means, you know, we take care of our own. We're responsible, and we spend our money on things we feel the need to spend money on and not what the government forces us to do. And certainly the NDAA is a perfect example of how something that may be well-intended gets completely out of hand and can be one of the most destructive things on earth. Dan, would you, how many states do you actively have involved in this process with these tax credits, and how many do you plan to go to every state in the union?
So we currently have one state where it's gotten to the bill drafting point, but we're active in probably about 15 or 16 states right now. We do intend not just on going to every state in the union, but and maybe not us, but the idea, the concept of this charitable credit, not only going to every state in the union, but community taxes and city, county taxes, they're separate from state taxes, and that requires a separate credit in their community. We want to bring this idea to any community in America who wants to decide that we the people should be represented by our government, that we the people should be able to direct our resources to those who serve our people the best. And that we the people should be able to come together and take care of each other, that if that community decides that that's something they're interested in, we'll write legislation for them. We'll be there to help. But at the end of the day, this, unlike a, you know, there's other concepts and proposals out there that might privatize certain things or make something private. We're not about forcing the people or making the people of the community get rid of a government agency or get rid of something that's out there. We'd like to say, look, if you guys, if you, the people of the community, want to choose where your money goes, we're happy to provide the legislation for you to get that done. And if you pass this legislation and everyone decides that we want to still send our money to the government and nothing changes, then that is your decision as a community. But at the end of the day, that should be your decision. And so we've developed legislation for many jurisdictions. We do intend to present this idea to every community in America, whether it's in Montana, whether it's in New York, whether it's in California or Illinois, doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, and go, you have the option here. We'd like to give you the tools to take back your community. And if you'd like to do it, we're here to help.
Mm-hmm. If we can duplicate in all 50 states the level of participation in taking the credit that Arizona has, just with the state level universal charitable credit, it would add about $2 billion a year to the coffers of local charitable organizations. Funded by the individual taxpayers. And we have one for Congress as well, for federal income taxes, that the numbers there would probably reach into the tens of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the hands of the people, doing better, helping people, reducing the need for growth in a lot of the government-funded, I say funded, but government-run public services.
Right.
And with the burgeoning debt and your baby boomers retiring, all those entitlement programs, federal, state, and local governments need to be looking at ways to reduce the growth in the highest cost areas they have, and public services are right there at the top of the list.
Yes, I agree.
Because their definition of public services is an asterisk, is everything.
Well, and one of the things that makes this program make so much more sense is that the money would be spent that much more wisely. Let's face it, when private enterprise, if it's well run, goes in and does something that had normally been handled by government, Dan, as you had said earlier, and I think you did too, Jeff, it's so much more efficient. So let's assume that even if it's twice as efficient.
Can I briefly cut you off there?
Just real quick. Sure.
Instead of assuming, let's work with actual numbers, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, i.e. the federal welfare program, for every dollar that a taxpayer puts into that program, 24.6% or 24.6 cents actually ends up in the hands of those receiving basic cash assistance. So let's work with a quarter, let's say.
Okay. The needy family. The very people the program was created for get 25 cents on the dollar put into that program. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you cut the waste by a third or shift the care from the government-run public service to the private-run nonprofit, you get twice the bang for the buck, or help twice as many people, or somewhere in between the two, help more people and it be better help and more timely. And everybody wins. The government wins because it doesn't have to worry about how to come up with all this extra money to pay for this growing need. We always got more people. The people that need help get better help quicker. And mm-hmm. the people that want to help. Dan talks about, and I want you to say it, Dan, because you tell it better, about the people that want the help being pitted against the people that need the help. Did you explain that?
Well, Dan was making a point there. I just wanted to provide some numbers for us. So I'll toss the mic back to him.
Okay. Well, I guess I want you guys to continue to flesh this out, but I just wanted to make the point when I said that government is incredibly inefficient, and 90% of the time or more, they do more damage than good with any of their programs, because they tend to be like a bull in a china shop when they go in and supposedly help people. But the other part of that, and that's certainly something you alluded to, Dan, is the fact that, you know, so much of the money that goes into these federal programs just becomes payroll for a bloated federal bureaucracy. And most of the time, these charities are run very low cost and very low overhead, and most of the money actually goes to those who it was intended to serve. So with that, I'll let you flesh more out.
Yeah, and the average numbers we've seen on that, for your listeners' sake, is about 50% of the money that federal agencies take in, they spend on administration and bureaucracy, whereas with nonprofit organizations, it's anywhere from 1% to 40%, but it tends to average around 30% for the nonprofits on administration. And you get into for-profits, you might even get more efficient. But the thing that Jeff was alluding to, one of the things that I think we want to bring to the discussion is, instead of an assumption that government generally just operates inefficiently, provide actual reasoning and specific reasoning as to why government does operate inefficiently. And we have on our website at wedobetter.org our best attempt and empirical attempt at finding those, we call them the 8 fundamental flaws of what happens when you ask government to provide a service. But what generally happens to create those flaws is when you have a nonprofit, Shakespeare said giving is twice blessed. The people who the nonprofit are helping benefit, and the people who are giving to the nonprofit benefit. Whether it's from something as wholesome as they just get a great feeling out of it and they love to help their fellow man, or, you know, more on the social pressure, they get social status, they get lots of other things when they work together with the people in need to help them out. The problem is that a lot of our public services today are also provided by government. And what happens when you ask government to provide a service is you take the people, let's say you had a $10 billion new program, which would be awful cheap by our government standards today. Let's say you had a $10 billion new program that $10 billion was taken from the taxpayers and is spent on feeding the needy. Well, over time, the taxpayers will start to be concerned about where their money's going. Are the people it's feeding actually being helped? Or are they just living off of this system? I don't have any choice, so I want you to change the system around. And so what will happen is there'll be new regulations put in place, and those new regulations will limit who can access that system and what the people have to do in order to do that, such as work requirements, such as other things. And then those people who have now those regulations, inevitably, they go overboard. They kick people out of the system who genuinely need help. And so those people come back and push back, and they go, no, well, we need regulations to protect us from these overbearing people. And they push back against the people who have to give. And you have this consistent back and forth where we actually, every time we institute a government program to help someone, we end up pitting those who want to help and who have the ability to help against the very people who need the help the most, and vice versa. And we end up not just with massive bureaucracy, but we end up creating victims on both ends. And we should be advancing ourselves toward a society, toward a future, toward an America, where when we help people, instead of creating additional victims, we lift both people, and we help both people, and both people benefit.
Okay, well, that makes perfect sense. I like the system. I like what you guys are doing. And I guess I want to make sure that you can tell our listeners ways that they can help you in this effort, because it makes perfect sense. It really is something that we need to work on, and that is not only providing private funding for charities in a way that you're talking about, but eliminating that tremendous government overreach that comes with these giant bureaucracies. I mean, the control mechanism is huge in this country, and anytime we can reduce the amount of control through programs like yours, that's something we really need to concern ourselves with. So tell me, guys, how can we help, and how can we get behind you to make sure that these things actually happen?
Well, one of the number one ways that people can help, we put together to make We Do Better happen. We put together a crack team of activists who have a lot of experience in other areas, whether, you know, with me with People Against the NDAA and Solutions Institute, or Jeff with Fire and Patriot Coalition, or Bobby Rodrigo, who's also on our board, who has spent most of the past 4 months, we won't get into it this program, but organizing one of the largest private relief operations in history. But he comes from the left side of the spectrum, the ACLU, the Coffee Party. We have a lot of, a couple people, probably a staff of about six or so, that we put together specifically not just to present a cool concept to the American people, but to actually put that concept into action. And so right now, there are two big ways that people can take the lead and also help We Do Better. Number one is, if you've listened to this program and you've decided that not only do we the people do better, but you want to help the people do even better, if you go to our website and you click on Get Involved, Jason will reach out to you, our grassroots coordinator, and get you started in your community. And number two, monthly donations is really what keeps us going and allows us to invest the time and effort that our team invests in the grassroots around the country. And we are aiming for 100 new monthly donors over the next couple of months. So if you go to wedobetter.org/donate or wedobetter.org and click on donate, become a monthly donor of $5, $10, $15 a month, that really does give us the resources we need to walk into a state, to a city, your city, your county, and help those people do even better.
And in reality, if you would A, make that monthly donation, and B, help us get the universal charitable credit passed in your city, your county, your state, then at some point you could take that donation as a tax credit.
yeah, that's true. Make, yeah.
And if you are already donating to charity, by virtue of opening it up with a credit, it does incentivize. And I know Dan has the statistics on that as well, that charitable giving goes up when there's an incentive. When they remove mm-hmm. the incentive, it goes down. So mm-hmm. what better, you know, we're all manipulated by the choices we make, or to the choices we make. But what better way to manipulate people by incentivizing them to make their own decisions about mm-hmm. where they spend their money? So there's nothing in this for us, except in the state where we're incorporated, if we could get it passed there, but we're not even targeting that first. We're okay. going where the people are showing the most interest, that are ready to get engaged in doing better. And supporting doing better, but We Do Better, the organization, and themselves, because ultimately it's about we the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me ask you this. This is one last question. What are you actually attempting to get this legislation passed in the state of Montana?
The minute that a few people come together and say, we'd like to get this legislation passed in the state of Montana, we will walk in with a piece of legislation, rally the people that we know, and hopefully help them rally the people they know. And if you'd like to step up, Dan, or you know somebody who would, we will get legislation in the state of Montana.
I know a couple of legislators that would very likely be people that would want to carry this bill. And the reason I asked is because I didn't want to interfere, but the fact is I would like to contact a couple of these legislators and ask them to get involved. So let me do that. On my end, I'll try to get back with you and have them get back in touch with you, and maybe we can get that to happen the next legislative session, which is 2019. So, okay, we're about out of time. What I wanted to ask you is very quickly, Dan, would you tell our folks how, besides what you've already given us, how they can support all the different things that you're doing through your various organizations, and one last word.
You can go to wedobetter.org for a primary organization right now, pandaunite.org, pandaunite.org for information and tools against the NDAA, and solutions-institute.org for tools and tips on your activism in your area, no matter your issue. And if there were one last word that I would like to throw out, it would simply be that not someday, not eventually, not we can do better, but today, right now, right here, we the people already do better. And if we recognize that and start supporting that, that is a solution I think everyone can get behind.
I agree. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for being our guests tonight. And I hope that our listeners will get on board and help you in any way they can. And with that, thank you again. And Kelby, I turn the show back over to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's show with Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. God bless. Good night. We'll see you next Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific.